I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm your host this morning, Denise Morris. We have a pretty packed show, so we're going to kind of get right to it. This is KBOO 90.7 Community Radio in Portland. Tammy Dean is our engineer this morning. Bill Resnick will talk about communities with Kathleen Walsh. She is on the board of Portland City Repair Project, and they will look at the question of how beautiful neighborhood spaces have a democratizing impact, generating trust and a sense of collectivity. Movie Moles, Angela Jones, and myself will talk about Al Gore's film, An Inconvenient Truth. But first up, what do moles, Shakespeare's Hamlet, Canaries in a Coal Mine, and Karl Marx have in common? Well, our well-read Fran Michelle is about to tell us. Back in January, following the West Virginia mining accident, Fran crafted a wonderfully thoughtful commentary about the effects of capitalism and capitalist ideology on the lives of working people. Listener response was so positive that I thought, well, what a better way to kick off our new summer feature, The Best of the Old Mole. So this morning, Fran starts us off with a well-read read.
What is this old mole, and how can a mole root down a mountain? We can trace the figure of the old mole back to Shakespeare's Hamlet. In the first act, the ghost of Hamlet's father speaks from beneath the ground, or beneath the stage, following and echoing Hamlet's demand that his comrades keep secret what they've seen. In reaction to the ghost's pursuit and speech, Hamlet says, "Well said, old mole. Canst work of the earth so fast? A worthy pioneer." The phrase was taken up by Hegel in his lectures on the history of philosophy, where he substitutes the spirit of the times, or spirit with a capital S, for the spirit of the ghost. He says spirit is inwardly working forever forward, as when Hamlet says of the ghost of his father, "Well said, old mole, canst work o' the ground so fast." Until grown strong in itself, it bursts asunder the crust of earth which divided it from the sun, its notion, so that the earth crumbles away. Karl Marx, of course, cared more for the earth than for its crumbling, and famously inverts Hegel's idealism. In an afterword to the first volume of Capital, discussing the mystification which dialectic suffers in Hegel's hands, Marx observes that, with him it is standing on its head, it must be turned right side up again if you would discover the rational kernel within the mystical shell. So Marx's old mole is not the spirit that speaks, but the revolution that grubs, that burrows, digs, undermines, or agitates. In an 1856 speech in honor of the anniversary of the Chartist People's Paper, Marx said, "In the signs that bewilder the middle class, the aristocracy, and the poor prophets of regression, we do recognize our brave friend, Robin Goodfellow, the old mole that can work in the earth so fast, that worthy pioneer, the revolution." But what has a mole in common with a pioneer? Both, as it turns out, are terms drawn from mining. A mole is a person who works underground, or a machine used for tunneling, and a pioneer is an old word for a miner. Miners have been in the news recently, among the latest victims of the transfer of resources from workers to capital. Pierre Tristram, on commondreams.org, notes that, in its crudest but truest terms, the West Virginia mining tragedy is an example of corporate dividends at the expense of workers' safety. As the Charleston Gazette's Ken Ward reported, the mine in Sago, West Virginia, was a documented disaster zone of safety infractions. But few make that connection between the cost of true safety in day-to-day working America, in the workplace anywhere, in the mines, in the meatpacking plants, in the rail yards, and the cost of corporate corner-cutting in the name of shareholder demands. In all, 5,703 people were killed in job-related accidents in 2004, the last year for which figures are available from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and 58 of those died in West Virginia. It takes money to pay for government inspectors of workplaces. It takes money and commitment to make the federal government's Occupational Safety and Health Administration be more than a wrist slapper. But the Bush administration despises regulatory agencies like OSHA and sister agencies like the Mine Safety and Health Administration, to say nothing of the Environmental Protection Agency. It starves them of money and authority, enabling companies working under them to snub their noses at them. In 2004, 8 workers at the Sago mine in West Virginia were injured badly enough to be kept off the job for at least a year. The entire year, the company sustained $9,515 in fines. They call that safety regulation. It's as toothless as a dentured crash test dummy. The bottom line isn't safety. It isn't keeping Americans secure in their job. It isn't doing what it takes to hold employers accountable for workplace safety. The bottom line is the bottom line. The West Virginia mining tragedy is a parable of Homeland Security America. That was from Pierre Tristram on CommonDreams.org. That transfer of resources from poor to rich has been going on a long time. It's currently known as capitalism, but it's been accelerated in recent years. The Institute for Policy Studies and United for a Fair Economy recently found that in 2004, the ratio of CEO pay to worker pay at large companies has grown to 431 to 1. If the minimum wage had advanced at the same rate as CEO compensation since 1990, it would be $23.03 an hour instead of $5.15. According to Citizens for Tax Justice, of Bush's $1.7 trillion in tax cuts, $578 billion, or 33%, went to the top 1% of income earners, while the top 20% of income earners received 71% of all tax cuts. Henry Giroux, in an essay on dissidentvoice.org, puts these economic developments in a broader context. He traces a series of authoritarian developments, including market fundamentalism, religious fundamentalism, attacks on critical education, and rising militarism. Giroux writes, "Recent revelations in the New York Times about the Bush administration's decision to allow the National Security Agency to spy on Americans without first obtaining warrants, the Washington Post disclosure of the chain of secret CIA torture prisons around the world, and the ongoing stories about widespread abuse and torture in Iraq and Afghanistan are just some of the elements in the popular press that point to a growing authoritarianism in American life. The government, as many critics have pointed out, is now in the hands of extremists who have shredded civil liberties, lied to the American public to legitimate sending young American troops to Iraq, alienated most of the international community with a blatant exercise of arrogant power, tarnished the highest offices of government with unsavory corporate alliances, used political power to unabashedly pursue legislative policies that favor the rich and punish the poor, and disabled those public spheres not governed by the logic of the market. Closer to home, a silent war is being waged against poor young people and people of color who are either being warehoused in substandard schools or incarcerated at alarming rates. Academic freedom is increasingly under attack. Homophobia has become the poster ideology of the Republican Party. War and warriors have become the most endearing models of national greatness. And a full-fledged assault on women's reproductive rights is being championed by Bush's evangelical supporters, most evident in Bush's recent Supreme Court appointments. While people of color, the poor, youth, the middle class, the elderly, gays, and women are being attacked, the current administration is supporting a campaign to collapse the boundaries between church and state." Giroux doesn't make the point, though we might, that fascism is arguably a sign of the disintegration of the capitalist system. But he does argue for the importance of critical education in responding to the authoritarian challenges to bourgeois democracy. Giroux argues that education is the terrain where consciousness is shaped, and the capacity for self-reflection and social change is nurtured and produced. He acknowledges that changing consciousness is not the same as altering the institutional basis of oppression, but stresses that, at the same time, institutional reform cannot take place without a change in consciousness capable of recognizing the very need for such reform or the need to reinvent the conditions and practices that make it possible. Fortunately, power is never completely on the side of domination, religious fanaticism, or political corruption. If the Sago miners are the latest in the flock of canaries in the coal mine of capitalism, we need to educate ourselves and each other to interpret the signs that bewilder the middle class, the aristocracy, and the poor prophets of regression. Here's one last bit of mole trivia for the day. A group of moles is known not as a flock or pride, but a labor. The labor of moles on today's show will be doing our part to read the bewildering signs of the day, to discover our usable history, and to root down the mountain of capitalism that threatens to bury us all.
Tell the miners, kids and wives, there's a blast in the number five, and the families I see standing at the gate. The inspector years ago said number five's a deadly hole, and the men most likely won't come out alive. Waiting at the gate, we are waiting at the gate. Smoking fire does boil and roll from that dark and deadly hole, while the miners, kids and wives wait at the gate. The inspector told the boss it was more than a year ago. You're risking these men's lives in number five. That hole's full of fumes and dust, full of high explosive gas, but the boss said we'll just have to take the chance. Waiting at the gate, we are waiting at the gate. Smoking fire does boil and roll from that dark and deadly hole, while the miners, kids and wives wait at the gate. Well, the men in the number five kiss their wives and kids goodbye, then they walk with their lunch.
Thanks to our well-read red friend Michelle. That was Woody Guthrie, Waiting at the Gate. Next up is Bill Resnick. He'll be talking with Kathleen Walsh. They discuss Portland's city repair project.
Kathleen Walsh, welcome to KABU.
Thank you, Bill. I'm glad to be here.
Kathleen Walsh works with the City Repair Project here in Portland, and she's a board member of City Repair. Kathleen Walsh, tell us about City Repair. There's so much going on in the city right now. I see you people doing. Tell us about it all.
Well, it's hard to talk about City Repair and sum it up in one or two sentences. The City Repair Project is a nonprofit organization headquartered in Southeast Portland. We have our main office on Southeast Division Street at 2122 Southeast Division. The City Repair Project basically transforms public spaces into welcoming neighborhood places. We do a lot of things. We support Earth Day. We have a 10-day event that just ended called our Village Building Convergence, and at the Village Building Convergence we bring people from all over the country to create neighborhood projects where people come together, design build wonderful gathering places out of sustainable materials using creative organic kinds of designs. We're all about bringing people together to enact their vision, Bill.
Let me give you a vision of a city that you might not think is really great. First, you'd start with a lot of barbed wire and fences. And all the houses, you know, would have these big fences with barbed wire on top and some broken glass on top of these sort of concrete kinds of structures, you know. And also what I really like when walking through some places is huge dogs who, when they take a look at you, begin snarling and spitting and sort of trying to get through the fence. It seems to me that's one model of, quote, community. It's, you know, highly frightened people, very privatistic, defended in every way. It seems to me that City Repair goes in exactly the other direction to create a city, even in the private, private lawns and things. I think what's so impressive is not just the public spaces, but so many private spaces. I mean, people where they own their, you know, the little lawns in front of houses and things. Tell us about some of those installations and what they aim for.
Well, you're absolutely right, Bill. The City Repair Project aims to bring people together in beautiful places that make them feel good about one another and glad to be together. What City Repair does, one of our missions is to recreate the commons. The environment you described is very typical. People isolated in their homes, even without barbed wire and snarling dogs, in the typical...
And frightened of others, obviously.
In the typical comfortable-looking community with nice houses set back from the street, people are alone and they don't get out on the sidewalk. They don't participate. the city repair project engages people. It facilitates neighbors to identify how they can create those common spaces. Yet you're right, some people contribute parts of their lawn. One of our main projects is called the intersection repair, where neighbors who own adjacent corners at an intersection can contribute a portion of their property to create, at that point of intersection, gathering places. Asked me in the very beginning to talk a little bit about how city repair contributes to the democratic process. And one thing that's vital to democracy is that people participate. In thinking about this interview, I thought it was most important to start out with the way our environment disempowers people. Just the regular grid work of streets set out in straight lines and at right angles, of houses set back from the street, creates an atmosphere in which we are pervasively held back from connecting with one another, stopping to talk and engage. In fact, that grid work that our cities are based on, the grid was originally a military strategy concept that was intended to keep people in check, that at that point of intersection, an armed sentry can look both ways and keep people back. And we have recreated that kind of environment without really understanding its effect. So the City Repair Project, it works towards taking out chunks of that rigid grid and creating organic, circular, inviting spaces.
Mm-hmm. Although the grid has some advantages because it can, in fact, move in that direction, whereas the cul-de-sac in the suburb, or sort of these winding streets with very big lawns around it, it seems to me cannot, in fact. They can have little communities, but they're little communities based because there aren't, and they don't have cross streets often, so you can't get to people except for walking long distances to somebody in another cul-de-sac. It seems to me it's true that the grid can be these little defended outposts that provide for very fast response by police and fire and all the rest. It's partly an engineering thing. But it also, it seems to me, because it's often denser, like the new urbanism our inner neighborhoods, there's a lot more people per square block, per block. It seems to me it offers also a real democratizing and non-automobile dependent environment.
You mean the transformed intersections offer that?
Yes, well,
yeah,
it could be.
Absolutely.
I think the grid itself, though, in fact, has some promise, whereas the cul-de-sac really doesn't have much at all except for...
Well, the City Repair Project is not involved in replicating cul-de-sacs. We're involved in creating commons, and most frequently we're doing that at intersections, but it doesn't have to occur at intersections. There's wonderful projects that are in the middle of a block where someone has donated part of their yard and created a poetry garden where people are enchanted and they stop and they look and they reach down and they pick out poems that people have placed to be read, and they, you know, turn to the person who's walking down the street next to them and they say, hey, have you read this? Or they walk away feeling vitally connected to someone who they know lives in their community. So what we do is we help people organize these projects. We don't necessarily do them, but we provide the support. We teach them, how to contact the city, how to work with the city departments where they need to get permits. We facilitate their the group process, how to organize, how to vision, and how to enact these projects. There's fabulous builders who use recycled and sustainable materials who create wonderful installations. I'm sure you've seen the little benches and you've seen the kiosks. out of
sometimes
renewable
they're nice, they're,
and...
They're really nice. Sometimes they're a little too cute for me. I have to, some of those with the multicolored sort of tiles and stuff and everything.
Mm-hmm.
It goes beyond my aesthetic, but it's beautiful in another way.
Well, and some of them are on school grounds. Like last year, we did a wonderful installation at the Sunnyside School, little bench shaped in like a serpent and a little kiosk, and it was great for kids. And some people like that aesthetic. You know, the thing about it is you can create anything you like. It's really up to the local people. And if you want to have something that's a little bit more minimalist and masculine, much as yourself, Phil, you're welcome to come to us, and we'll help you create that.
I am not. I'm a teddy bear, I think. Anyway, this is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. You know, there's another thing that's really nice about the city repair thing, which is also really nice about people who just do beautiful lawns that are not just in-facing the house, where, in fact, it's clear that what they're doing is creating something, not lawns, in fact. I mean sort of semi-gardens. Mm-hmm. I don't mean lawns at all. But where it's sort of looking out, where the beauty of it, the prettiness of it, the aesthetic values are for others, and it's where people, and for themselves, for the people who live there, but it's for their neighbors, it's for the people who walk through, and there's something, it's a city with barbed wire is one thing. It says, "I'm afraid of you. I don't want you around. I don't like you, and I don't think and." I see your horrible potentials. A really pretty garden in a front yard, even if it's not city repaired, which would be, even more communal with benches and things and messages. It seems to me that really, it's an expression of a different way of life and a different way of seeing people than the barbed wire city.
Well. Of course, you're absolutely right. It's a signal that I care about this environment and I care about your participation in this environment. You asked me about democracy. When people, the democratic process, the city repair project and creating those kinds of gardens that invite people in, that supports democracy because we have to be engaged in order to participate. And people are feeling disempowered and alienated. But when they come together, the barriers of suspicion and prejudice break down. When you get to know your neighbor, you understand that person on a human level. Also, the assets in a community, the social capital, the combined pool of talent and interest is magnified. People come together, they learn who's got what skill, they combine skills. They develop deeper relationships, and in the process, they understand that they can affect change in their community. And that feeling of empowerment is what fuels the democratic process. And, and we're reclaiming that in the City Repair Project. It's not about the installations. I mean, it is about those benches and those cob walls and cob buildings, but it's at its core, it's about the people. It's about investing energy to make our community a better place.
You know what we have to talk about next, although we don't have time now, but next time we talk, let's talk about the way in which those sort of feelings that are created, those values that are expressed, then influence the overall political process. Like, for example, if people really feel good about their cities and they feel good about their neighbors, they're much more likely, in fact, to recognize that if you raise taxes to do public transportation and better schools and all kinds of environmental protection, their lives would really be better. Rather than the defensive thing, they can see a collective society. And I think if I have any reservations about the City of Repair, I wonder to what extent they're working with others to within the political sphere that's so necessary, it seems to me, for our cities. But I'm not going to let you respond this time, Kathleen.
Oh, that's too bad, because I have a lot to say.
We'll do it again.
Okay.
City Repair is a great project.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Bill. Thank you for having me.
We'll talk about those sort of political questions another time.
Okay, great.
Thanks a lot.
Sounds good. You're welcome. Thank you.
thanks to Bill Resnick and Kathleen Walsh. Next up are Movie Moles, which includes me, your host, Denise Morris, and Angela Jones talk about the film An Inconvenient Truth. And to remind you, this is KBOO Portland Community Radio. Now, the movie reviews, usually we try to talk about the movie, and we don't usually have to investigate the character of any particular actor. But in this case, the subject, Al Gore, will play quite a significant role in our review, so we hope that you will enjoy. And we had great fun investigating, but we also had a bit of a heavy heart in looking at this film, An Inconvenient Truth. Kirk Honeycutt of The Hollywood Reporter has this to say about the documentary film An Inconvenient Truth. Quote, "There are two agendas behind Davis Guggenheim's An Inconvenient Truth. One is to bring to a much larger audience former Vice President Al Gore's fascinating multimedia presentation of the facts and issues arising from the phenomenon of global climate change. The other is to reintroduce to the American public a man we thought we knew, but clearly did not. The film succeeds on both counts." End quote. I say, the good news is, former Vice President Al Gore brings his informative multimedia presentation on the facts and consequences of global climate change to a much larger audience in the documentary film An Inconvenient Truth. The bad news is, Al Gore brings his informative multimedia presentation on the facts and consequences of global climate change to a much larger audience in the documentary film An Inconvenient Truth. Is this the man we thought we knew and now know to be not so bad after all? Or is the man Al Gore upstaging the horrors of global warming by being the man some of us knew, only worse? There is some good, some bad, and some real ugly. But we movie moles will try to sift through the elements and uncover some inconvenient truths about the man delivering this very important message. Davis Guggenheim follows Al Gore across the world as he delivers a slideshow designed to expose the average citizens to the issues, facts, and consequences of global warming. The science of global warming is drawn out using illustrations, maps, graphs, explanations, and stories. This is all done in a language we non-scientists can really understand. Al Gore and interesting are not often heard in the same room, but Al provides appropriate humor and personal anecdotes to make this a surprisingly interesting presentation. We're not trapped in an auditorium for an hour and a half. The film actually follows Al as Al goes. Hotel rooms, reminiscences on the family farm, photographs and musings. He is shown to be an enormously passionate man, frustrated by the years of failure to convince U.S. politicians of the importance and truth of climate change, global warming. This is precisely why Gore is taking his show on the road in an attempt to mobilize a more grassroots movement of citizens who will put pressure on their representatives to take action against continuing environmental crisis. This is a complex problem that Americans must begin to address and take seriously against the many detractors working to discredit the science, the scientists, and the activists who have dedicated their lives to these issues. It really is the slideshow that is the strength of the film.
There's a lot here.
and we will be shuffling papers.
And a small part of it is good. No, that's not true. Actually, the hard science here is really the most compelling part of the movie. And for me, I in some ways was very moved by his presentation and his, you know, the man, the mission. And this is a subject that is very near and dear to me, as well as many people who live here in the Pacific Northwest, as well as the world. There are some disturbing facts that the hard science bring to us. And first he kind of starts with, this is what has happened. This is where we are. So I'm just, you know, a couple of them are Category 4 and 5 hurricanes have doubled in 30 years. At least 279 species of plants and animals are already responding to warming trends, and they're all moving north to the poles, well, both ways to the poles. Malaria has spread to higher altitudes, up to 7,000 feet above sea level in the Colombian Andes, because of a lack of hard frosts. And the list goes on and on. There are a lot of charts. It's a little overwhelming. There are a lot of disturbing pictures, worldwide pictures, showing glaciers, let's say pre-industrial photographs, as recent as last year. And some of these glaciers are totally gone. The Swiss Alps, I think he goes to Kilimanjaro, there's a picture. It's pretty disturbing.
He does a lot of before and after. You were mentioning the Swiss Alps and Kilimanjaro, areas that would see heavy ice pack for long periods of time. We're now seeing through photographs the withering away of that ice pack over time. He also he seems to place himself in good company. He actually is a fairly decent storyteller, and he talks a little bit about growing up, some of the professors that were influential for him, particularly as a young boy. And he talks about during the 50s there were two different teachers that he had who had very different approaches. One who was very dismissive of some of these ideas that the Earth actually wasn't quite broken up the way it is now, and another who was very involved in early climate change research. And so Gore comes out of a personal history of being educated by people who are very involved in this stuff. And so
at Harvard, and the professor that you're referring to, I actually can't remember his name offhand, but he was a real pioneer in making the connections between CO2 emissions and the gradual and now rapid warming of the Earth. And there's this amazing chart that he shows of the natural warming and cooling cycles of the last 650,000 years. And this man has, and his accomplices, he's no longer alive, has been measuring the CO2 emissions for the past 30 years or so, I think since 1968. And every day there is a weather balloon that is released from the same point. And this is superimposed on these natural cycles that he points out. The right and many people who are suspicious or doubt or purposely maybe look at global warming as a theory and not fact for other reasons we will get into in a second. And it's disturbing. You see superimposed the CO2 emission goes up rapidly, and so does the warming of the Earth.
It is a. It's interesting. It's a complicated idea. What is going on? But he had this real, very accessible way of talking about it. And I mentioned a few of the ways. He also had a cartoon that was made specifically by Matt Groening, who's the Simpsons guy. And there was a little bit of humor in it. We're also taken places that many of us will perhaps never get to go, or most of us will never get to go see. And what also is a little bit heartbreaking is that those places are changing so rapidly that they won't remain the same. And we're talking about, you know, Antarctica and Greenland, areas that many scientists confirm are the most scary signs of global warming. And I wanted to mention that one scientist, Jim Hansen, who actually works for NASA in one of their departments, he is also a professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences, and very much confirmed that the science Gore is presenting in his slideshow is very valid, very current, and supportable. And Gore also has a number of scientists that he's collaborated over the years and has images and documentation of some of the research that they've done.
And a real focus of the presentation is specifically talking to the individual and individual behavior modification. What can I do to make a difference? And one of the facts is the average American generates about 15,000 pounds of CO2 a year from transportation, home energy use, and the energy produced to make the products that we love to consume. Here are some of the disturbing what ifs. If we don't take care of this, what's going to happen? If nothing changes, global sea levels will rise more than 20 feet above sea level with the melting of Greenland and Antarctica, which is rapidly happening. This would include much of Portland. It would include a lot of everywhere, coastal areas everywhere,
Florida.
Totally covered. A lot of Manhattan covered. And more than a million species worldwide driven to extinction by 2050. And the Arctic Ocean could be ice-free in the summer by 2050. Really disturbing stuff. And, yeah, interspersed with some photographs, including here and there, which leads us maybe to some of the things that aren't so great, maybe a few of the not so great things about this film, the bad. You did say the good, the bad, and the ugly, right?
Yeah, we're just getting to the bad. Well, what we're getting to actually we'll call problems with the film, which will then lead us to the real ugly. But there are some, for progressives and for the left, some very noticeable problems with the film. The most glaring problem is, where is the corporation? We do see that one image of the smokestack, but otherwise we're supposed to, I guess, believe that people are just driving around aimlessly in their cars polluting the air with no, where to go. They don't have jobs. Nobody works.
Nobody's rushing around making money and going to buy stuff.
Yeah, producing that oil. So this is glaring, and as we get into the ugly, we'll sort of unravel this a bit, but the film does really present the problem as an individual problem, and that the solution is very behavior modification, and this is what we can do. But Gore does not touch the corporation.
He has been, as he's been stumping around promoting this film. I think he was recently on Saturday Night Live last month, and David Letterman this past weekend. And, that's his thing. He's saying he's going to the people. He's given up on 20-something years of being in Congress and being in Washington and not getting anywhere with politicians. So now he's going to the tried-and-true grassroots organizing and coming to us to tell us what we can do. And in that way, as far as an educational, there is a lot here, and I will recommend to go see this film. It is disturbing, and the facts are there, and the hard science is there. I think there are some criticisms about that. I think there's some sugarcoating, and again, that connects to the ugly.
There was one scientist who said there were problems with some of the science, but they were primarily about interpreting data, and that was not so wasn't so bad that those things couldn't be changed. But yet, you have to go pretty deep to get. If you go to the right, you're going to find a lot of criticisms of global warming. And, unfortunately, as we get into the ugly, we'll really do realize that Al Gore is an easy target. He's an easy target for the right because they oppose the idea that global warming is even scientifically based. And they also see Gore as a liberal, blah, blah, blah. Now, then on the left, we may see Gore as a liberal, blah, 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 as well, but for different reasons. And he is an unfortunate messenger, and we could get into the. Why don't we get into the minor ugly? We can talk a little bit about Gore's early political life. He is pro-life, although he does support Roe v. Wade today, or did at some point. Well, we're not sure how long that could last. He was also very openly anti-gay, calling homosexuality abnormal and wrong, did not believe that it was simply an acceptable alternative that society should affirm. That's a quote. He voted in Antonin Scalia. He also was publicly supportive of Clarence Thomas, but did not vote for him. And he was one of only 10 Democrats to break with the party and vote for President Senior's Gulf War in 1991. That's kind of the easy stuff. A lot of us know that Gore was supported NAFTA. The Clinton administration's neoliberal politics of privatization, deregulation, globalization,
and he's
very supportive of all of this stuff.
And that includes environmental regulations in the U.S. that, as we know, along the border now, that's part of NAFTA. Those guys don't have to follow that. And it's really contributed to, it's a major contribution. That is the elephant in the room.
Al Gore is the elephant in the room. He really is. I have a quote I love from Clinton. It's regarding this environmental policy. He says, "The invisible hand has a green thumb," basically suggesting that the free market will correct its problems. The free market will act morally, blah, blah. This is the kind of line that, only a good neoliberal capitalist could hold to, is the idea and belief that somewhere in capitalism there is a moral center.
In his own state, he has a horrible environmental record. And I'm just going to point out a couple because there were many, so I had to kind of choose. But he was responsible for exempting this proposed dam in Tennessee along the Little Tennessee River from the Endangered Species Act. It was revealed that a tiny fish, the snail darter, would be endangered of becoming extinct, and he waved him through. Champion International Paper for 90 years was responsible for dumping byproducts, tons of byproducts from bleaching wood pulp into the Pigeon River in North Carolina and eastern Tennessee. If anyone out there has been to Dollywood, Pigeon Forge, Pigeon River, color of coffee, smell of sulfur. And then another one, which is literally in his backyard and really tells a longer story of a really tainted history with an oil company, Occidental, is Al Gore Sr. sold some of this beautiful farm that we see in the movie, sold a chunk of it and sold zinc rights to Occidental Oil. And 10 minutes later, they sold it back to Al Gore Jr., obviously hiding some financing of future campaign funds. And that's equaled $20,000 per year and more than $500,000 over the years that Occidental has given illegally to Gore. As well as Gore's mother in her name is more than $35 million worth of shares in this company to this day. This is going on now as he is, you know, stumping this this film. And then Occidental, it may sound familiar to some people. They have a long and dirty history. Denise, are you familiar?
I'm familiar.
Well, Armin Hammer is his name, and he incidentally was named after the hammer and sickle symbol of the socialist movement, and his father was Julius Hammer, a Ukrainian immigrant who founded the American Communist Party. Interesting. It's interesting for a couple of reasons later on, but and this guy had a really dark and sordid business past, as well as a few murders that he got away with, some including a slush fund that helped out with a little thing called Watergate. He contributed over $50,000 to that. Arsenal Oil was responsible. It was a subsidiary connected to the contaminating of Love Canal in the late 70s, dumped tons of dioxins into a residential neighborhood there and caused a lot of problems for many families, reproductive cancers, on and on, kidney, respiratory. Back to the zinc in Gore's backyard, they now have a beautiful pond that we didn't get to see in the film either of trailings from zinc mining. And I think that company has been responsible for, I want to say the legal is 0.65 milligrams per liter. That is okay monthly and a monthly average that you can have. And this company was way off the charts with 1.49. And
per day or something.
But luckily, they knew the Gore family, and they were rated in the 90 to 100 percentile for the dirtiest, worst facility in the U.S. in Clarksville, Tennessee, and are responsible for cadmium compounds, which is the worst for worst 10% for ecosystems and human health. So, whoa, pretty bad.
Does that have anything to do with why he didn't carry his own state in the 2000 election?
It does, because everybody knew he was lying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Occidental.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. Movie moles are currently talking about An Inconvenient Truth, Al Gore's film about global warming.
There's all sorts of.
Most recent is, and this is very recent, and it's confusing to me. I don't understand. Al Gore is saying he's not going to run for president, and yet there's some conflicting stuff here. Occidental Oil just recently, in the past 10 years, went to Colombia and tried and did for a while push a native tribe off their land so they could drill. And these folks, the Uwa tribe, I believe, organized, and they got in front of the drills and protested. And Occidental was able to get the military might, a little bit help, of help from the U.S. as well as the Colombian army to come in. And they mowed down a bunch of people and ended up killing, I think, 18 of the people, members of the tribe, including three children, which to me is quite disturbing, because one of the compelling ways that Al Gore uses his personal experience in this film, he kind of shows how he's ended up, why is this his mission? And he uses the story of his son, who was, I don't know, maybe 7 or 8, and there was a near accident, and he was in the hospital for months and almost died. And Al Gore says it really made him think about, you know, what was going to be left behind for this generation, and losing this prized possession, his child. And yet Al Gore was hand in hand with these guys who was responsible for killing these three kids.
It's sobering, it's difficult because the information is so important for people to see. People have to understand what it is that's actually happening in terms of climate change, and yet this person really is unfortunately beyond probably the worst person that could be the messenger. In our own state, folks will remember the Salvage Rider, which was known to environmentalists as logging without laws, which I suppose that could be attached to a number of different bills. But and it's been considered the most gruesome legislation ever enacted under the pretext of preserving ecosystem health. And we can liken this to Bush's Healthy Forest Plan, bills that are chock full of deception and special interest pandering, on and on. It's a very interesting article, and probably an important article, by Joshua Frank on counterpunch.org, Inconvenient Truths About the Ozone Man, a very informative and good place to go to kind of build on your Al Gore repertoire. To kind of wrap up, Angela, you did do a lot of research into some of these connections. Is there anything else that stands out, juicy tidbits that you think people must hear before we leave?
Well, them? I love that he tries to drum up some support at the end by saying, you are a part of an amazing country who have, you know, we've been able to really turn it around. And he uses the example of defeating communism, which really rankled me in my chair. And there is this incredible connection here, this family connection to this man who was the founder of the Communist Party, of the in the U.S. anyway. And the fall of the wall, he says, and he was in bed with another guy in Russia who was a business man who couldn't wait to make money when that wall came down and capital free market and free market has devastated the globe, and that is what the movie should have been about. That's the focus, and that really was the huge miss here.
Mm-hmm.
I still encourage people to see it, because I do think, as I look around, people, you know, are eating off paper plates with plastic forks, and trash is still, you know, in my neighborhood and many others. I'm seeing people still throw trash out of their car windows. I mean, I don't understand. So that kind of stuff, you know, I mean, yeah, there is a great primer. This is a great primer for people who need to know how to live a little more clean. And climatecrisis.net is the website that's connected to this movie, and it gives you, you know, a lot of examples of what the individual can do, and they are important. The corporations, unfortunately, are the true criminals here.
Well, they're feeding the cycle of consumption, and consumption is something that people must get away from. But it's also kind of a difficult scenario, because often folks who are more economically challenged don't have access to solar panels, or, I mean, this is a real issue.
Or buying a hybrid.
Yeah, buying a hybrid, or
but
even
again,
a $6 light bulb, you know, in the moment is a lot more expensive than $5 for $1.49. I mean, these are all issues that, you know, can be addressed over time, and environmentalists who are dealing with this stuff are going to address this a lot more easy than Al Gore, the politician who has blood all over his hands. So, well, Angela Jones and Denise Morris, that's me. We were talking about An Inconvenient Truth, starring Al Gore. A film, in spite of all of it, we do recommend people go see. There's good science, and it's an important issue. So, all right, thanks.
this has been the Old Mole Variety Hour this Monday, June 26th. We thank you for listening. Tune in next week. We will be back for Independence Day.
KBOO Youth Collective will bring you the Underground Wednesday, June 28th from 6 to 7 p.m. Our theme this month is body modification and body image. We'll have stories about first tattoos, steroid use, fad diets, and more. We'll also feature youth poems from Cleveland High School and the band King. Two nine-year-olds associated with the Rock and Roll Camp for Girls. That's Wednesday, June 28th from 6 to 7 p.m. here on your KBOO 90.7 FM.
And you are tuned to KBOO 90.7 FM. Coming right up, it's Health Watch with Dr. David Naiman. He speaks with Hensi Gore today, author of The Thinking Woman's Guide to a Better Birth. At 10:30 on Earthwatch, the guest is Elizabeth Colbert, author of Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change. 11 o'clock on Democracy Now!, hear a defense attorney and community advocate involved in the case of seven men arrested in Miami last week on charges of conspiring to blow up the Sears Tower. And also immigration rights activist Nativo Lopez speaks about the future of the Senate immigration bill and war, peace, racism, and the World Cup. All coming up on Democracy Now! At 11 right now, here's David Naiman with Health Watch.